Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present writer and activist Kevin Gray, who challenges the many declarations made that Barack Obama's inauguration as president signals the fulfillment of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of racial and economic equality. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Chris Hedges, author of War, A Force That Gives Us Meaning, who examines the possible repercussions of Israel's assault on Gaza, which left over 1,300 Palestinians dead. And Phineas Baxendall, senior analyst with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, who discusses his organization's disappointment at Congress's proposed budget for mass transit projects. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
President Barack Obama faces a quandary about what to do with the other Gitmo, the huge detention center at the U.S. Air Base at Bagram near Kabul, Afghanistan, which currently holds 700 prisoners. The detention center was first set up as a screening center in late 2001 as U.S. and allied forces ousted the Taliban regime. It currently houses twice the number of prisoners as detained in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In a 2005 investigation by human rights groups, accounts surfaced of detainee deaths, torture, and disappearances at Bagram. At the time, the U.S. military pledged to turn the facility over to the Afghan government, but the transfer never happened. According to the Interpress Service, a recent confidential report by the International Committee of the Red Cross described disturbing conditions at Bagram, including continued abuse of detainees. The American Civil Liberties Union insisted conditions at the Bagram prison were as bad or worse than Guantanamo. Thus far, detainees at Bagram have been excluded from the U.S. court decisions giving prisoners held at Guantanamo the right to challenge their detention in American courts. As president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Tim Geithner had a front-row seat in dealing with the global financial meltdown. He also helped orchestrate the bailouts of Bear Stearns and Citigroup. But during the housing boom, Geithner loosened regulations on Citigroup and put off requiring the financial giant to increase its ratio of capital reserves until after the financial crisis ended. Over the last year and a half, Citigroup has lost over $92 billion as a result of bad investments. After the federal bailout last fall, Citigroup decided to split the company between its traditional investment banking business, which is still profitable, and its toxic holdings in credit default swaps, debt securities, asset management service, and consumer finance divisions. In addition, Citigroup sold off its controlling interest in its Smith Barney brokerage firm to Morgan Stanley. According to investigative reporter Jeff Girth, Geithner, President Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary, loosened regulation of Citigroup during the boom years when the financial giant doubled its amount of debt on its balance sheet. During this time, Citigroup made huge profits on little-understood collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, whose value crashed during the credit crunch. In 2006 alone, Citigroup doubled the number of CDOs it bought and sold from investors, and the number of Citigroup-originated subprime loans grew by 85% from the year earlier. The Christian Science Monitor reports state unemployment offices are swamped as the number of layoffs rise faster than the states can keep up. Unlike previous recessions, many states now require the unemployed to go online or call a special phone number to apply for jobless benefits. Now, those seeking benefits have overloaded servers and jammed phone lines. Some estimate that only half of those seeking benefits can get through to file a jobless claim. In Ohio, the state usually gets 7,500 calls a day about unemployment benefits. In early January, they were getting 80,000 calls a day. Pennsylvania has seen a 16% increase in jobless claims and has hired hundreds of temporary workers to handle the increased volume. For the last 2 years, Washington State Representative Jim McDermott has sponsored the Unemployment Insurance Modernization Act, which would give the states $7 billion to expand coverage and update computers. But some states and Republican lawmakers are opposed to the bill because it would extend unemployment benefits to some part-time workers, people with family emergencies, and workers in state-sponsored training programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu. ¶¶
As the nation celebrated what would have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 80th birthday on January 19th, history was made the following day when America witnessed the swearing-in of its first African-American president, Barack Obama. Many commentators and politicians noted this historic moment by declaring that Dr. King's dream of racial and economic equality had been achieved 40 years after the civil rights leader's assassination. While there is no doubt that President Obama's election victory has shattered old barriers in U.S. politics, it should be remembered that by a 12% margin, most white voters cast their ballots against Senator Obama, and his Republican opponent John McCain had voted against the creation of a national holiday for Dr. King in 1983. What's more is that by many measures, life expectancy, access to health care, infant mortality, and the accumulation of wealth and property, African Americans lag behind America's white majority. Among young black males aged 16 to 19, the unemployment rate is 32.8%, while their white counterparts are at 18.3%. Overall, the ratio of blacks and Latinos who are in poverty compared to whites is 4 to 1. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with writer and activist Kevin Gray, who takes issue with the notion that Barack Obama's election victory signals the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream. Gray assesses the work that must be done by America's progressive movement to put pressure on President Obama to pursue public policies that will bring us closer to King's vision of racial and economic equality.
You know, this idea of Dr. King saying, "I've been to the mountaintop and I've looked over," for anyone to believe that the promised land that he saw, that what he saw when he looked over was the White House, they're kidding themselves. And even before Barack Obama, there was always an effort to sanitize Dr. King's message. I mean, the dream. Or, you know, Barack will pull out a quote, "the fierce urgency of now," or Biden in his farewell speech to the Senate, "the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice," or "judging a person by the content of their character, not by the color of the skin." People pull out the easy things, but they don't pull out the fact that Dr. King was against the idea of American empire. They don't pull out the fact that Dr. King talked about an edifice that produces beggars needs restructuring, and that there was a third way between capitalism and socialism. This idea of drawing a straight line from Dr. King to Barack Obama, saying the dream has been realized, is all, in some ways, a way to diminish the important structural work that Dr. King talked about and worked for and died for, and it almost makes moving forward Dr. King's message irrelevant, and that the pinnacle of black political progress or poor people's progress is to be in the White House, to be with the power brokers, to run the empire as opposed to change the empire. I find that distasteful, and I find it troubling.
There's no doubt that Barack Obama's election as president has broken new ground, very dramatic new ground in U.S. politics. But we have to remember that most white voters cast their ballot against Barack Obama, and his Republican opponent, John McCain, voted against the creation of a national holiday for Dr. King back in 1983. There's still a lot of work to be done, even at that very superficial level.
You know, I've been saying to folk and trying to make there is an opportunity for the real left. I'm not talking about the Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid left that the national media wants to declare. I'm talking about a real ideological left, the people that write for Counterpunch, the people that write for the Progressive Magazine, the people with Code Pink. I mean, there's an opening if we organize and educate folk that we can force this government to do the right thing. We can force Barack Obama to do the right thing, or he'll be a one-termer. And I don't even think we ought to give him a honeymoon. You know, there wasn't any hesitation to give Wall Street a bailout and to support socialism at the top end of the food chain. There is no honeymoon. You got to work, and you got to work for the people. And tell us what it is in that stimulus package that helps us. Tell us what you're going to do as it relates to the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. That is not going to be another 4 years in Iraq. He's saying 16 months, but it could possibly be almost his entire term, that he's not going to expand the number of troops in Afghanistan and this idea of increasing the size of the military, that our money needs to go for social restructuring, for infrastructure, for saving some of these kids who have been victims of maybe their own stupidity in some regards, but the drug war and how that has wrecked people's lives in ways that we both know about. How is he going to solve the housing crises? So those are the kinds of issues to me that are important. Housing, education, how that infrastructure money is going to get to the folk most in need. Now, you know, you look at all this stuff. Who he's chosen for his cabinet, who supported this campaign, the erosion of campaign finance reform, wanting to put people in deep sleep about how it is that he got to where he's at in relationship to the civil rights community. The idea was to increase the number of black elected officials to represent our interests, not just to be placemats at the emperor's ball.
Do you see signs that progressive groups in this country are getting geared up for the pressure that's going to be necessary to make the changes that Barack Obama can't or won't make on his own?
Well, at least we're doing it rhetorically. I haven't seen the on-the-ground kind of organizing that I would like to see. You know, we see a lot of virtual organizing. Everybody organizes on Facebook, mm-hmm. You know, but you still got to go to the meetings, and you still got to figure out a way to educate people outside of somebody else's venue. You still have to figure out a way to move people to the face of power when you have to move them. And as it relates to boycotts, you know, I like boycotts and economic actions because people respond when you get in their pockets. So it can't be all virtual. You know, some of it requires that you get out into the streets and demand change and get into their faces, and then you push for legislation, and then you fight in court. You have to do it all, and there's a need to develop new organizations that organize around multiracial, multi-issue, coalition-style politics. Now, we've got to remind people that the opportunity for Barack Obama to be president of this country didn't arise simply because he appeared. It took years and years of struggle and work, and there's years and years of struggle and work ahead.
That was writer and activist Kevin Gray, author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. Read his articles online at counterpunch.org. Israel's three-week military offensive in Gaza ended as if perfectly timed to coincide with the end of George W. Bush's presidency and before Barack Obama took the oath of office on January 20th. Israel and Hamas both declared a unilateral ceasefire on January 18th. Israel stated that the attack was launched on December 27th to stop Gaza's Hamas government from firing crude rockets into southern Israel. The death toll resulting from the Israeli-Gaza assault is estimated at more than 1,300 Palestinians, many of them civilians. Israel reported that 10 of their soldiers and 3 civilians were killed during the Gaza operation. Several Arab nations accused Israel of using radioactive depleted uranium munitions in Gaza, a charge that Israel denies. Many observers link the Israeli government decision to attack Gaza with the quest for political advantage in the nation's February 10th parliamentary election. The ruling Kadima Party's foreign minister Tzipi Livni and Labour Party defense minister Ehud Barak are hoping to overtake Likud Party leader Benjamin Netanyahu, who is currently ahead in the polls to become Israel's next prime minister. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges about the repercussions of the slaughter of civilians in Gaza and the connection between the many injustices suffered by Palestinians and the decades-long conflict.
I'm certainly no friend of Hamas. You know, I've been very harsh about religious fundamentalism of all types. I don't approve of their tactics of using suicide bombers. Hamas, when they took power in 2006, carried out a series of executions of opponents within the Gaza Strip. The rocket attacks are a war crime. But I think that we have to understand that all of this doesn't negate the legitimacy of Palestinian resistance, armed resistance, to the Israeli siege and the occupation of Gaza. That the use of violence on the part of the Palestinians is in direct response to the violence of the occupation. And when you belittle, humiliate, and oppress a people for as long as the Israelis have oppressed the Palestinians, violence is a tragic but normal reaction. That's what happens. And I think that that sort of has been lost in much of the debate, that it is Israel that is not only in violation of UN resolutions, but in violation of international law, as the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, Richard Falk, has repeatedly pointed out.
And of course, your main message I took away from the column titled Peace is in the Eye of the Beholder, is that we constantly hear from our leaders, whether they be in Israel or in Washington, that the ends justify the means, that the disproportionate violence and slaughter launched on combatants and civilians alike in Gaza is justified because Hamas has launched crude rockets into Israel, and this was the only way that it could be stopped. And in a tough world where we live, is there an alternative, I guess? That's the question I think we're all asking.
Well, I think that the Israeli response has been deeply counterproductive to Israel's long-term security interests. Not only was it wildly disproportionate, I think the UN says now that 50,800 Palestinians are now homeless, some 400,000 are without running water, more than 1,300 Palestinians have been killed, and now that the firing has stopped, relief agencies are finding whole neighborhoods flattened, so the number of dead is certainly set to rise, and to rise significantly. The tragedy of the entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been, ever since the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, has been an attempt by the Israeli leadership to crush the Palestinians. And unfortunately, that kind of a tactic, which has been long the Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, has given rise to a militancy, an Islamic militancy, not only within the Palestinian community. When I first went to cover Gaza and the West Bank, the leadership was decidedly secular, as was most of Palestinian society, but has fueled radical Islamic movements throughout the region.
Chris, is there any hope that Barack Obama can go where past presidents have not in brokering some long-lasting peace here?
I don't think much is going to change in the Middle East under a Barack Obama administration. Israel has, they call them facts on the ground, but Israel has created a situation on the ground that pretty much makes the viability of a Palestinian state impossible. The vast expansion of Jewish settlements on the West Bank during the Bush administration, the use of a security barrier or a wall, which doesn't run along the 1967 Green Line, demarcation line, but dips deep into Palestinian territory. Well, once all this links up with ring roads and restricted military zones, and the UN has drawn up maps that have shown this, Israel has essentially or will, by the time they're done, seize about 40% of the West Bank, including most of the aquifers. And I think that it's very clear now that the Israeli policy is to reduce Palestinian existence to a subsistence level of misery, to make sure that Palestinians are completely hemmed in and ringed by the Israeli military, so that if they become too restive, all movement, all food, all supplies can be shut down, as they've done in Gaza and as they've done on the West Bank. That is their policy. I think that it is one that will come back to haunt Israel, but it's very clear that the possibility of a two-state solution died with Yitzhak Rabin.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Hedges served as the New York Times Middle East bureau chief for nearly 7 years. Read his column, Pieces in the Eye of the Beholder, online at truthdig.com. As part of the economic stimulus package President Barack Obama is calling on Congress to pass, the House Appropriations Committee, as one of its first orders of business in early January, approved a version that includes $30 billion for highways and just $10 billion for mass transit. Environmentalists, urban planners, and civil engineers have called the $10 billion a drop in the bucket of what's required to wean America off its addiction to fossil fuels. According to groups advocating a major investment in mass transit, the U.S. government has spent 9 times more on highway projects than on public transportation. They argue that as transit ridership and gas prices trend upward, the time is right to shift the nation's priorities on transportation issues. Light rail and pollution-free bus systems are among a list of recommended transit project options. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Phineas Baxendall, senior analyst for tax and budget policy at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. His organization researched the state's transportation wish lists and concluded the proposed budget doesn't bode well for developing a transportation policy for the 21st century. Baxendall explains how the proposed $30 billion could be better spent.
From our point of view, we don't need to be building new superhighways. We certainly shouldn't be prioritizing it. You know, we should be investing in projects which are going to decrease our dependence on oil, not increase our dependence on oil. Unfortunately, the stimulus bill, the economic recovery bill, does not have controls to make sure that the money will be spent on repairs as opposed to new capacity. It has some accountability measures which will stop, you know, fraud and abuse, but not to make sure that the money is actually spent on the right kinds of things. We did a study. We've been collecting the state wish lists from different departments of transportation, and what we found was really troubling was that most states, their wish lists, when you look at them, the road money, the highway money, that is, a majority of those states would give a majority of that money to new highway capacity, to widening lanes and to building new superhighways, as opposed to doing the repair work that we need. You've got some states where it's, you know, for instance, Wisconsin would spend over 86% of their road money, according to their own wish list, on new capacity. Vermont and Massachusetts would spend 0%. They've got their priorities right, at least according to the list that they've put out.
And that money would go toward repairs then?
Yeah, that money would go to repairs, to retrofitting, to preventative maintenance, and projects of that sort. Which makes sense. You know, we shouldn't have any more Minnesota bridge collapse type disasters.
Well, like city streets that need to be fixed, they wouldn't be included in this plan?
Right, which is a real problem. I mean, there's a list which we put together as part of a national coalition we work with called Transportation for America, where we put together a list of $1.2 billion worth of pedestrian and bicycle projects, which are extremely ready to go. Often they don't need any kind of pre-zoning or environmental studies. They're some of the most ready-to-go, shovel-ready kinds of projects there are. And there was, you know, as I said, $1.2 billion worth of projects that were listed there, but that didn't get into the stimulus bill either.
So there's no money for bike and pedestrian improvements?
The bike and ped stuff, as departments of transportation decide to, they can use some of the highway money, they can flex in a way that they can be improving sidewalks and things like that. But there isn't money which is specifically for the bike and ped. You know, so we really leave this up to the states, which, you know, in some states is may be fine, but in most states it's a real problem. When we, you know, brought these lists to light, we were told by some states, you know, why there isn't transit. They just said, you know, in Arizona, they said, well, we don't operate transit. And it's true, but it reinforces a bad situation where you have departments of transportation that consider themselves still highway departments. They see themselves only as about highways, and therefore what the money they ask for, the things they push in Congress, are just highways. So they don't think about transit. They're not going to build it. They're not going to operate it. They're not going to ask for it. Florida told us, bizarrely, that they thought they were supposed to exclude public transportation from their list, which makes no sense.
Well, Phineas Baxendall, what kind of mass transit projects were proposed, and how much could be funded with the $10 billion the House is proposing?
$10 billion is going to be spread, it's going to follow the peanut butter model, which is how things that go through Congress often work. They get spread thin to cover the whole bread, and that's how they maximize votes, but it isn't always the best policy. So there aren't going to be a lot of big, bold projects for the future coming out of this. There'll be a lot of vehicles which will end up getting repaired, signal modernization, kind of small bore projects that will probably improve service in some places. There'll be some smaller projects which will get built as a result of this if they already had their engineering and environmental studies already. But the way the stimulus bill requires, you know, things to happen very quickly in 120 days, unfortunately, our federal funding system is such that it has much slower process for public transportation. So if anything isn't really fairly ready, it's not going to move. On the good side, there's been such a backlog of projects. The New Starts program, which is the largest program for new projects, has what at current levels of funding would be a 50-year backlog of new transit projects. There's a lot of projects there which are just waiting to get moving. So there's a lot of things that could be funded if there was enough money there, but we fear that it's going to be spread so thin across different states that you're not going to see a lot of dramatic new projects move. One of the things that's really missing in here that's very disappointing is money for operations. So when you think about new money for public transit, probably your listeners think about your local transit authority and how maybe they've had to cut back on bus lines despite the fact that there's record levels of ridership going on. And that is something which will not be changed at all by this economic recovery money. There is not a dime for transit operations as opposed to capital projects.
That was Phineas Baxendall of U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or USPIRG. Contact USPIRG in Boston at area code 617-747-4370 or visit the group's website at uspirg.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.